Might as well get started. Okay, so it's a, very nice to be here. So I'm literally got on the plane last night, so I'm feeling a little bit slightly spaced out, but it's nice to see a bit of sunshine for a change, having come from London where it's been very cold and grey for the last couple of months. So I've been following a little bit some of the, although I've not been here, I've been following some of the talks that people have been giving, and I'm sort of know some of the guys who've been speaking. So I got some idea, I guess, of some of the things that people have been talking about. So hopefully some of the things I'll be discussing and mentioning won't be, you'll be sort of reasonably familiar. But I've put some sort of introductions in for some of the immunological stuff as well, just to try and cover all the bases, really. So I work in a research institute in North London. I'm in Mill Hill, the National Institute for Medical Research. And the kind of the main sort of goal of my research program is to sort of better understand the mechanisms regulating homeostasis of the peripheral, of the T cell compartment. So this really covers developmental processes as well as maintenance processes. So, I mean, you've probably heard of, there's been sort of discussions about sort of various cell types throughout the meeting. But the, as I say, the sort of the compartment I'm most interested in is this compartment up here, the T cell compartment, which is with the B cells forms the adaptive component of the immune system. And you can see it's only sort of one part of a much larger system, cellular system, that mediates immunity, but is, you know, nevertheless is a pretty important compartment. So as I say, the focus of my lab is to try and understand the mechanisms that regulate the size and the composition of this compartment. So I think compared with other developmental systems throughout the body, the hematopoietic system's kind of an interesting one because it's, you know, it's constantly sort of developmentally active. You know, it's quite different from a kidney or a liver, which obviously goes through sort of development and embryonic stages. In contrast, the immune system is constantly renewing its the cellular populations which mediate its activity. And so, you know, one of the striking things I think about this system is that despite the fact that you're sort of generating these cells throughout life, you kind of wonder why you don't fill up with these lymphocytes and kind of explode from having too many. And what you find actually is that the sort of the compositions, so this is showing you a little cartoon of the peripheral repertoire, where you've got sort of naive T cells which are sort of waiting to recognize their antigen, and you've got memory cells which have been through an effector fate and now are sort of, this is the basis for sort of immunological memory. So the composition of the T cell compartment with respect to sort of naive and memory and for CD4 and 8 as well actually is remarkably constant throughout life. So this really sort of suggests that there are very specific mechanisms which, in spite of these sort of variable fluxes in generation of cells, you know, cells getting to different stages and either stopping or if they see antigen expanding and moving on, the sort of the size and composition is clearly subject to specific regulatory mechanisms which keep the size of these compartments pretty constant. So those are the sort of things that we've been interested in understanding, developmental mechanisms and maintenance mechanisms. So the question I want to focus on today, though, is some work we've been doing. So we sort of, so most of the work, about two-thirds of the work that I do in my lab is really using sort of mouse models of the immune system, where we can manipulate signaling pathways to ask questions about how these different signals regulate homeostatic responses and developmental processes. But in, you know, the last sort of 5 years or so, we've also become interested in using sort of more quantitative approaches to try and understand the dynamics of these processes, so using mathematical modeling tools. And, you know, a lot of this is born out of the fact that, you know, a lot of the stuff we do is actually counting cells. You know, we make a manipulation on a mouse genetic system, and then we read that out by counting cells. And it kind of, you know, occurred to me that, you know, it's pretty obvious that for all the data that we're generating, simply making cell counts is quite a sort of crude manifestation of that data, and there's probably a lot more information we could get out of it if only we had the sort of the appropriate tools. So we sort of became interested in using mathematical tools, and this was really borne out with interactions with Robin initially and Andy Yates. So the work I'm going to show you today is really looking at trying to understand the dynamics of thymocyte selection. This work's been done in collaboration with Andy at Albert Einstein College of Medicine. So the thing that we sort of, the question we sort of got interested in, and it's, you know, it's one of those things that immunologists talk about from time to time over the decades, is really this it's a sort of very well recognized feature of the adaptive immune system that you always have more, seem to have more, you generate and have more CD4 than CD8 T cells in your immune system. And as I say, it's a sort of very well recognized characteristic of the T cell compartment. And you see it in humans, you see it in mice, it's clearly well conserved. It's been used as a sort of diagnostic indicator in conditions, you know, such as HIV and such like, where you get perturbed homeostasis. But you know, one of the things that's, you know, a constant theme, I guess, is that it's not really been clear, you know, what this ratio means, or indeed why the adaptive immune system, the T cell compartment, actually generates T cells. So this is actually showing you sort of mature cells in the thymus to kind of give you an idea of the ratio in which these cells are generated.
71%, 13%.
Say again. Well, that's, I mean, it's a little bit variable. Yeah, sure. And I'm not a mathematician after all, so you know, you can't expect me to get these kind of ratios exactly right. I take your point.
In the periphery, is there a ratio?
Yeah, so the ratio in the periphery is about sort of 2-1.
Okay.
So they're generated at about 4-1, and depending on sort of some of the things you're looking at, you can. It's about 2-1 quite typically in the periphery. And you know, I think one of the things as well, Irene. Yeah.
So when you say conserved of species, is this skewed, or the actual ratio is
the skew. So I mean, the details, you can find different strains where it might be 6-1 or it might be 3-1 or okay. But it's always more CD4s than CD8s. And a lot of another sort of important point with these sort of ratios that people have seen different ratios. But you know what we're sort of quite sort of purist about it, I guess. We try and break it down into, rather than just looking at the whole T cell compartment, where you've got a mixture of cells in different states of differentiation, and you might have different numbers of naive and memory cells. You know, we look at it in terms of generation in the thymus, which is the ratio we look at here, but also looking at naive ratio in the periphery. And so and some strains which have different ratios, it's actually a manifestation of aberrant memory homeostasis, for instance. So if Treg compartment's a little bit skew with, then actually you get more memory CD8 cells coming out, and that can skew the ratio. So we're kind of, this ratio, I guess we're mostly sort of talking about sort of what's generated from the thymus during development, and for the naive ratio, so which is going to be at least in part a function of the output. And I think when you get to memory, some of these things, obviously, you know, the ratio is not going to be regulated in the same, or it's not going to be, you know, quite the same, because there's going to be issues of, you know, CD8 and CD4 memory are quite different from one another. So the ratio you get there is actually more a function of effector cells rather than sort of homeostasis as such. So the same, I mean, this really came as this sort of somewhat age-old question, and then just talking to Andy in the pub, and we sort of came up with this idea on the back of a bar mat, essentially.
Would you taste in beer, Amstel Light?
It's okay, it's Google's taste in beer, that's fine. It's not from my personal beer mat collection. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about, say, is mostly focused on thymic development. So if we, and so there's a number of sort of issues here, I guess. I mean, the first is to think about what thymic selection is actually trying to achieve. And to my mind, there's kind of two principal roles for thymocyte selection. First is issues of tolerance. So I'm sure this has been discussed a lot at the meeting. Obviously, during development, you get a random generation of T cell receptors, a random repertoire generated, and then obviously you need to identify the cells which have a useful T cell receptor. And so there's obviously this, there is this selection process which tries to sort of wheedle out the useful receptors. And there's two issues here. The first is that if you're naturally going to generate T cell receptors which can recognize self-peptide MHC with a high avidity and are potentially autoreactive. So thymic selection has evolved to actually remove these T cells from the repertoire, and they get actively deleted. On the other hand, you can get T cell receptors which have no intrinsic ability to recognize self-peptide MHC. And I think there's a lot of growing evidence. Well, I mean, it's one of those sort of repertoire issues that recognition of self-MHC is important for reactivity to foreign, but even amongst the repertoire, I think Ron Germain's got some nice data where he sort of looked at how self-reactivity amongst the peripheral repertoire actually is a good sort of indicator of reactivity to foreign. So having some intrinsic level of self-reactivity is pretty important. And so cells whose T-cell receptors don't recognize self-peptide MHC at all will die by neglect. And so what you're after is this cell in the middle, which has a little bit of reactivity to self-peptide MHC, which will hopefully enable it to recognize foreign. So I get rid of cells which are not useful is an important function. The second key role for thymic selection is actually the generation of the two key lineages within the T-cell compartment. So this is actually the CD4 versus the CD8 lineage specification. And obviously it's very important during this process that the T-cell receptor's ability to recognize either class 2 MHC or class 1 MHC is correlated with its ultimate lineage development. So class 2 restricted receptors, you want those to develop into CD4 T-cells, whereas class 1 restricted cells, you want those to develop into CD8 lineage T-cells. And those are sort of two some slightly different purposes for thymic selection. And I just sort of highlight this here because it may come up as being a sort of important issue later on. So in terms of the developmental process itself, we have we have very excellent sort of qualitative understanding of the process of thymic development. So this is a cellular view of what's going on. So the thymus obviously is this organ that sits just above the heart where the T cells are generated. And if you look histologically, you can see this sort of lobular structure whereby you can see this sort of dense cortical region and a sort of lighter appearing medullary region within the thymus. And if you have kind of a little zoom in on this, then you can look at your cortex and your medulla here. And so you get progenitors coming in from the bone marrow. And they initially come into the thymus as double negative T cells. So at this stage, they express neither CD4 nor CD8. And during this stage, they go through a large amount of cellular expansion. They start rearranging their T-cell receptor genes, and this is part of the repertoire generation process. So they rearrange their TCR beta first, and if that's successful, then they start rearranging their TCR alpha genes. They upregulate CD4 and CD8 and become double positives. And it's at this stage then that cells are undergoing this selection process to identify cells with useful receptors. And so from some work we've done, there's lots of different ways in which you can phenotype this population to identify cells at different stages of selection. But the one that we use allows us to identify cells at different temporal stages. So this actually gives us an indication of how long they've actually been in undergoing the process of positive and negative selection, which actually proves to be very useful. So we can use the T cell receptor itself as a marker and this CD5 marker, which is a negative regulator, in fact, of T cell receptor signaling. We use that to identify different compartments of double positives undergoing selection. So cells which are expressing low levels of both CD5 and T cell receptor. So these cells have their sort of mature T cell receptor on the surface now, and they're ready to audition for thymic selection. So in the first stage of thymic selection, as we identified, is this intermediate T cell receptor stage with high levels of CD5. And this contains both CD4 and CD8 lineages. And then CD4 lineage cells differentiate directly from this stage, whereas CD8 lineage cells undergo this obligate sort of third stage of double positive maturation where they upregulate their T cell receptor to a higher level and they lose a little bit of CD5 before they ultimately mature into the CD8 single positive. And this happens with very sort of distinct timings.
There is a previous stage of pre-metal selection where it binds with the
pre-T alpha.
Yeah, the pre-T alpha. Uh-huh. So does this has any effect on CD4 versus CD8, or is
good question. Whether that would, I mean, the main purpose of that process obviously is to identify beta chains which are, can be successfully, in frame rearrangements which can be successfully expressed. So whether that actually has an effect. I mean, maybe that's something we can come back to, and you can see the sort of what we've sort of been looking at, I guess. So hold that thought. I'm not sure, but it's something for discussion, I guess.
Do you have a good sense of all the dynamics of the stage and how many cells, how much proliferation of that stage?
Yeah, so that's one of the questions we sort of addressed specifically about sort of death, and I haven't got the data about proliferation, but I can mention that. I mean, most of the expansion obviously occurs at this, when they proliferate through this stage, but most of the cellularity of the thymus occurs from between the sort of DN3 and DN4, where they'll undergo, four, five, six divisions, and that's enough to go, to give you a sort of tenfold expansion in numbers. But once they get to this mature stage, then they're pretty much non-cycling. And we've done experiments where if we take this population and we can label them with cell dyes like CFC, and then do transfers back into thymus, you can see that they don't undergo any further proliferation. So it's really all the proliferation's all going on through this stage here. And by the time that they're in this nice double positive stage, then they seem to be non-cycling. So that's the dynamics from the T cell side. And obviously the way in which this process is directed is, oops, what have I done there? Oh, that's clever. Is by interactions with thymic epithelial cells or dendritic cells expressing self-peptide MHC, interacting with the thymocyte, and delivering some kind of signal to the T cell, which will direct the T cell to undergo lineage development, apoptosis, or negative selection. So obviously the TCR signaling is key in regulating these processes. So in terms of sort of positive and negative selection, there's obviously this sort of, if you think of signal strength or avidity of TCR for self-peptide MHC, then you can kind of draw a picture a bit like this, where you have avidity of T-cell receptor for self-peptide MHC, frequency amongst the repertoire you've got at that double positive stage. And I was drawing this on the bus last night, which is why there's a bit of a wobble there. But when I was drawing it, I was thinking, what shape should I be drawing it? And I really didn't know, if I'm being sort of perfectly honest. But this is kind of what most people draw for a sort of a distribution of avidities. But I think we don't have a really very great sense about exactly what this shape is or how tight it is. And where these margins exist. So, you have this range of avidities. Most of the cells, as I say, are going to be recognizing MHC, self-peptide MHC, very poorly or not at all, so they die. Some cells, and it's not clear really how many, what the size of this population is, but the very high avidity clones are going to be deleted because they recognize self-peptide MHC too highly. And then somewhere in the middle, people estimate, or the estimations have been something like 5% of receptors actually have a useful recognition of self-peptide MHC, and these are the ones which give rise to your peripheral repertoire. But I think that the sort of the dynamics of this curve are certainly very much up for debate, and where as I say, what the true shape of this might be, and where these boundaries really lie.
Even these percentages are calculated from precursors or from after TCR?
Well, I mean, that's exactly the point. So, and some of the stuff we're doing is going to throw up some sort of discussion of what these values are. But these sort of estimates are what you see people publish in papers, when, and really what they're looking at is percentages of single positive thymocytes. Really, that's, and that's, I think that's kind of where a lot of this So enumeration is kind of informed by. So in terms of sort of lineage commitment, so we've got positive and negative selection. In terms of generating CD4 and CD8 single positive thymocytes, there's a number of there's various different models about how the signaling is interpreted, but you know, that's not something I'm really going to touch on today, but only really to say that for distinguishing CD4 and CD8 lineage, I mean, it's what's very clear, I think, that I think everyone agrees on, is that the signal transduced by the T-cell receptor plays a very important role in distinguishing those lineage fates. There's debates about whether cytokines are involved at some stage and the strength, whether it's strength of signal or whether it's duration of signaling. But essentially for a CD4 lineage, it's either a very strong or a very persistent signal, which is involved in commitments, whereas for a CD8 lineage cell, it's either a sort of abrogated, a broken signal or a much weaker signal. But what I think what's clear is that the sort of qualitative nature of that T-cell receptor signal seems to be very important for helping the thymocytes decide whether they're class 1 or realize whether they're class 1 or class 2 restricted.
So how do you interpret that? Because once you move to the periphery, you can get very strong signal from this CD8 T-cell. So you're saying that in the thymus, there is no self, which gives you a strong signal for CD8?
Well, I mean, yeah, presumably there must be, you know, cells that will get negatively selected. I mean, that's, you know, down to this distribution and whether that's the same for CD4s or as class 1 and class 2 restricted cells.
The right graph, you're saying that the distribution you have a small window for CD4 cells and a small window for CD8s, and they're separate.
That's sort of how you interpret these signals. I mean, that's one of the debates. I think, you know, it's not going to be, you know, CD8s are here and CD4s are there. I think it's not quite, I mean, that doesn't work really, because I think, you know, you can play around with the signaling a little bit, but it's, and sometimes you can get CD4s to become CD8s, but it's not always the way that you can kind of ramp up the CD8s to become CD4s. I mean, I think the timing actually of the signal actually plays an important role, and we've done a little bit of work on that, looking at how the timing of the positive selection signal, you know, when the cells actually receive that signal, is actually an important discriminant. And it's quite difficult to have a sort of simple, you know, I think this decision isn't made at the same point in the positive selection process, because otherwise, you know, you'd think you should have, you know, negative selection of CD8s at one range, CD4s, and then negative selection. And that, with the various experimental models, that never quite, doesn't quite add up.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So in the positive against negative selection slide, the previous one, it seems that positive selection is the most stringent test. Many cells just bad.
Yeah.
And I don't know anything about this, but every time we have numbers like this, it was the other way around. The negative selection was the most stringent test to pass.
Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah.
And I'm just wondering, how much should I trust these numbers, 90% stuff like that?
Do stringent in terms of, it depends what you mean by stringent, I guess.
I'm quoting a
Do you mean by?
Maybe a mistake, right? Positive selections, right? Maybe you get,
you said negative. Yeah, positive selection, you get 50% of cells, and out of the 50 or 90%, 1% has negative selection.
Negative, wrong, right? It's a good thing. What was the number from that? What's more stringent, positive or negative?
I'm trying to think what do you mean by stringency? Do you mean by
number of cells coming up, right? If you
what has the biggest impact on the repertoire? Well, I think that's, I mean, it's not clear, I think, is the fair answer there. That I think, you know, so obviously you get cells which get positively selected, and at some point they're going to get a negative selection. And depending on how you, I mean, it's quite difficult to measure negative selection, but where people have done genetic models where they knock out the pathways involved in negative selection, you might get in some instances, I mean, the estimates vary actually from, you know, being a fraction of the positively selecting cells to actually being something in excess of the positively selected cells. And it's not, I think it's not really well established.
Yeah, when people look at repertoire, they see a lot of clones you would expect to be negatively selected to be present. Right.
Right.
So the argument is that it's not so stringent. Negative selection.
These numbers are perfectly what the common goal is, 90% or so to die by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, this
5% include leak.
Yeah.
Being selected. Very similar.
Yeah, I mean, I make that point just because the, you know, this will be important later on as well than some of the things we were seeing.
So, excuse me, this neglect kind of 90% of cells gets to be double positives?
Yes, yeah. So they get to double positives, and at that point they've got their receptor and they're asked, you know, is this receptor useful?
So they get
or
to
not?
Proliferate first, and then they are,
yeah.
Which doesn't sound like a very efficient mechanism, right? Because you first amplify a big clone, which
well, the yeah.
Right.
So the proliferation actually is just you have the beta selection checkpoint where you've got one of the chains of the TCR has been successfully rearranged, and that's the proliferation then occurs at that stage. And actually, they haven't, you know, as they're going from here to here, they've got their beta chain, but they haven't got their alpha chain. So although they're expanding at that same time, when what actually happens is this beta chain it assembles with the pre-TCR alpha chain, which and you get ligand independent proliferation. So you've got a normal beta chain, you've got something just to keep it on the surface, and it transduces a signal which makes the cells expand. And during that expansion, so you'll have one beta clone, say one, you know, beta chain will then, as the cells are undergoing rearrangement of their alpha chain, you can have multiple alpha chains rearranging with the one beta. So it's quite a, you know, it's the beta chain first, and then you'll have one beta chain pairing with a repertoire of alpha chains, essentially. So you're not expanding individual clones. It's not like you're going to end up with, you know, hundreds and thousands of cells with an identical receptor. They'll have the same beta chain, but different alpha chains.
I was curious whether this death by neglect happens during this, you know, let's call it proliferation, right? Or afterwards, or before?
I mean, it should be afterwards, I think. So, you know, if we measure death in, follow the thylacines through death, then, you know, the double positives, then, you know, they have a half-life of about 3 days once they get to that double positive stage.
Just to fix ideas, one single rearranged beta chain, the cell carrying it will proliferate and go through rearrangements of the alpha.
Yeah, exactly.
So I heard you say something like 5 or 6 rounds of proliferation, so 2 to the 5 or 2 to the 6th cells. Now, presumably, we have one beta chain and possibly different
and exactly.
And
yeah.
Of those, maybe 5%, assuming random choice, will make it through this.
Exactly. Exactly.
So
yeah.
I might actually have a couple of alpha chains associated with a single beta chain, something that makes it through thymic selection.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when does the alpha chain rearrangement happen on the graph?
So it happens from that sort of double negative, it's in the sort of the double negative 4 stage. So the DN3 stage is the test for a beta chain, and any cells which pass that test, as soon as they go through, they can start rearranging their alpha chain. And that carries on up into the double positives, because, you know, the first alpha chain, for instance, if it doesn't work, then the second gene can be rearranged.
But there is some cell cycle arrest at the peak of rearrangement for the second
change? The precise timings, I think, I know you can get alpha chain rearrangements continuing through the double positive stage. I don't know. So which you're saying, can you get it continuing alpha chain? I think they continue to sort of rearrange it, even the double positive.
RAG expression, there was sort of a danger time, and it was better for the cell to be quiet and for most of that rearrangement.
I guess that's probably, maybe it's true, you think, in terms of sort of tumorigenesis and stuff, having this genomic instability. Yeah, I mean, the RAG is expressed up and through the double positive stage. So during that proliferation, they're still able to, they're still rearranging.
Certainly for the beta, I'm fairly sure that's right, that they slow down.
Yeah, no, that's right, yeah.
But I didn't know whether that happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the rearrangement occurs at the double positive stage, and you can see cells with different levels of TCR, which gives you some idea of whether they've rearranged their alpha chain successfully or not.
Okay, I mean, this group is very interested in repertoires.
Right.
We had a lot of discussions.
Okay, yes, I gather, yeah.
We've had discussions on how many revisions you go back, have after the beta chain rearrangements.
Right.
Get some estimates, is, you know, how many alpha chains could be different alpha chains. So have you done CFSC or somebody else to really pinpoint what the distribution
from the
revision number
yeah,
is?
Yeah, not from the double negatives. But I mean, what we have, I mean, it's at least, I would say it's at least, where it can be as many as 7 or 8, because we've done it some intrathymic injections where we've had those CFSC labeled cells. And actually what you find is that you, because you're transferring a few double negatives, you actually see those cells expanding up, and they're all CFSC negative. And so to have become CFSC negative, they have to have done at least 7 or 8 divisions probably. But we haven't specifically done the experiment. You know, if they're only doing 3 or 4 divisions, we see them on the CFC for sure.
So is there any significant variation difference between variation in MHC1 and MHC2 type 1? Is there an imposed different strength of selection on CD8 and CD4?
So in terms of the expression itself of the MHC?
Also the type of receptors that you see. So if you have six alleles of MHC1,
how much of a difference? Yeah, I mean, so in the mouse, I mean, actually, for like the strain we use, it actually only happens to have one functional class 2 molecule and 3 class 1
and then the,
types.
The trio is sort of on average are different in one individual, the different types.
Yeah.
So that somehow imposes less.
So is there a limit on selection signals?
Yeah.
Question. And I think that's probably not the case. As I say, just because in the mouse, it's the other way around that we have this sort of one MHC2 molecule type, and then there's 3 for the class 1.
And just to reiterate this, if you dilute out the CFSC, it doesn't have to be 7 or 8, all we know is that's a lower bound, right?
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, it could be more than that.
Right,
yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
CFSC for the average, and CFSC might give you the whole distribution if you put better than the tracks, right? Because if they rearrange the beta chain, they have to have a track. And so if you look at the average, what fraction has tracks,
right,
that gives you directly how many divisions they went to at standard size. And then you look at the alpha chain track, and you can do the big, and then you have.
So has that been done for the tracks on the?
Yeah, I think it's.
I'm sure it must have been.
6, 7, it's about 100 folds. Right?
Yeah.
Compared to the alpha.
Yeah.
Compared to the alpha.
So what you see is you get about 5 million DN3 cells and you end up with about 100 or 200 million DN4. So that's, you know, about that 6, 7 divisions.
This round of division depends on MHC?
No. So the initial proliferation is, say, with this pre-T-alpha molecule, it's a sort of smaller molecule which pairs with the beta chain, and the proliferation you get there is ligand-independent, is the thinking. So in terms of the CD4 and CD8 ratio, then, I mean, actually it's, in some sense, it's actually quite a simple question, because there's only really two non-mutually exclusive origins of, you know, why you would get a CD4 bias. So the first is that there is intrinsic differences in the precursors for class 1 and class 2 restricted precursors in the double positive. So I guess in terms of repertoire generation, you might perhaps for some reason the T cell receptors which are randomly generated happen to be more intrinsically restricted to class 2 than class 1. So you end up with more class 2 restricted precursors, and that's why you just generate more CD4s. And the other possibility, which isn't mutually exclusive, is that there's differences in efficiency with which the two lineages undergo selection, you know, for some reason. So the way that we've been sort of addressing this then is to be generating models where we can manipulate T cell receptor signaling so that we can actually have a control over the selection process. So the molecule we've used is this kinase ZAP70, and it's a useful TCR signaling molecule because it's one of the few signaling molecules, at least, which gives you a block at the double positive stage of thymocyte selection. So ZAP70 is downstream of the T cell receptor signaling. So you have the Src kinases, which are initially activated, which phosphorylate the CD3 complex associated with T cell receptors, which allows ZAP70 recruitment and activation. And it's because thymocytes also express SYK tyrosine kinase, which is a family member, it's the same family of tyrosine kinases, that there's a bit of redundancy between these two kinases, but SYK is switched off at the double positives. So even in a ZAP knockout mouse, they can get from here to here using their SYK, but then the SYK's lost and the cells get trapped at this double positive stage. So the way we've exploited this then is to generate mice where we can conditionally express the ZAP70 kinase using this tetracycline-inducible system. So the main feature of this system is that it's an antibiotic-regulated transgene. So if we administer doxycycline to our transgenic mice, it binds this reverse tetracycline transactivator protein, which then gives you activation of a ZAP70 transgene. And then we have the mice on an endogenous ZAP70 knockout background, so they have no ZAP70 expression, only comes from our inducible ZAP70 transgene. And we get a pretty good reconstitution of ZAP70 expression in these mice, whereby it's a little bit broader than you find in a wild-type mouse, which you have in black here, but it's in the same sort of ballpark as wild-type.
So these mice look fine?
They look fine in terms of, I mean, as I show you, the thymic development's pretty okay. It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. The peripheral repertoire, or the peripheral T cells. So one of the things with this inducible transgenic system is that the transgene is expressed at a much lower level in the peripheral T cells, and this causes some kind of interesting homeostatic issues, whereby you get this. Naive cells don't do very well with that, and as that compartment shrinks, the memory cells actually can expand a little bit out of control. So the periphery doesn't look completely normal. But we use these mice mostly for a limited sort of 6 to 10 days of induction, so we don't have to sort of worry about any peripheral issues as such. So as I said, because the selection process is dependent on TCR signals, what we can have in this mouse is, if we, with our transgenic system, we have the mice off doxycycline with no induction of ZAP70, they look exactly like a ZAP knockout mice. And then we can feed the mice doxycycline, and then we can reconstitute thymic development, and we can just look at the dynamics of this process in some detail. So this just kind of gives you an example of the sort of time course data we can generate looking at. So this is looking at double positive thymocytes here, looking at their TCR and CD5 expression. And so this is the sort of part of the data which gave us the indication that these markers would be good markers of some temporal stages of development, because you can see this sort of DP2 population comes up very early in development, and the DP3 cells take a little bit longer to come out with this sort of high level of T cell receptor. And then if you look at the CD4 and CD8 single positive cells as they emerge, you can see that just one day after ZAP70 expression, there's a little hint of some cells starting to downregulate CD8 and become CD4 lineage, and they're very apparent by day two. You have lots of CD4s. And quite interestingly, and this is what I was kind of alluding to a little bit earlier about the idea that CD4 and CD8 cells may be getting TCR signals at slightly different times, and this could be also an important factor determining interpreting the TCR lineage commitment decision, is that you don't see the CD8 lineage cells developing until much later on. So you get CD4s first, and then CD8 single positives, they trail behind by about a couple of days or so. So this is with our ZAP70 inducible system. And one of the things we were a little bit concerned about was, this is a transgenic ZAP70. We defined with some detail this temporal dynamic and kinetic of single positive, double positive maturation. So we wanted to be sure that this was at least resemblant a little bit of, this was a good model of wild-type thymocyte development. So, and also these precursor product relations that we were seeing were also sort of valid. So to establish, what I didn't say is that, as I mentioned earlier, as if it was a fait accompli, that this population here, that this DP3 population, is exclusively gives rise to CD8 lineage cells. But when we were at the time we were doing this study, that was, you know, a little bit controversial. So we had to sort of jump through various hoops to actually validate this. And it's, you know, it's a useful validation. So what we did was we sort out these individual populations from a normal wild type mouse, and then we inject them directly back into the thymus, and then recover the cells and follow their development with time. So if you do look at DP1 thymocytes, then you find that, you know, you can see a very similar order of events. You can see DP2 cells appearing within 24 hours, which is what we see in the TETZAP mice. You can see CD4s coming out 2 to 3 days. And you don't see any CD8 single positives really until about day 4 or 5. Again, shortly preceded by the appearance of DP3 cells. And, you know, one of the things, you know, to show this data and using wild-type thymocytes, and, you know, one of the reactions is, well, why use the TETZAP system? Why not just use wild-type thymocytes? And these are really, I'd say, these are pretty excruciating experiments to do, because you're putting in very small numbers of cells and you don't get very many back, so it's biologically very, very noisy. So it gives pretty good qualitative data, but the quantitative data is much harder to work with, and that's why we kind of favored the TETZAP system, which gave really nice sort of reproducible data. So in terms of the DP2 population, when you sort that and put that in, then this gives rise to both CD4 cells and at a later time point CD8 single positives. So this has both lineages present. And then for the DP3 population, sort them to nice high purity, transfer them, and you can see that actually pretty rapidly they become CD8 single positive. So that's the kind of the basis for the sort of the developmental scheme, of thymic development, whereby the DP1 cells have both lineages which go through this DP2 stage. CD4s select very rapidly within 24 hours, and CD8s take somewhat longer, about 3 days, 3 to 4 days to emerge, and they have to go via both the DP2 and then this obligate DP3 stage. And as I say, these importantly, this developmental schematic identifies cells at distinct temporal stages of development.
So if you take the DP2 cells and the ones that then become, some of them become CD8, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Do they go through DP3 stage?
Yeah, exactly. So if you look, you can see the DP3 cells here coming through.
Can you look at this data and tell perhaps you number of cells, and it looks like there is a collapse over here. Day 3 when you start on DP1, and day 2 when you start on DP2, and day 1 when you start on DP3, there's a collapse of one of those cells.
Yeah, and that's a good observation actually, and that will come into the talk a bit later. In fact, as I say, these are quite difficult experiments to do, and the reason for that will become apparent as I go through the other data. But these are all the cells we recovered from a whole thymus. So we recovered the thymus. Normally, for a FACS experiment, you'll stain, you know, a million cells and analyze them. For this, we did the injection, and then we actually take the whole organ. And we run the whole organ, which might be 200 million cells, through the FACS. And this is sort of showing all the cells that we recover. So it's these intrathymic injections are kind of inherently, the recoveries are pretty poor. So they're quite difficult experiments to do. But as I say, the precise reason for this will become obvious as we go through.
Can I ask on this, where does the intermediate CD4 come into play with this? CD8 SPs, does it get turned on at DP2? No, right, it's after that. So it's independent. The CD4 intermediate expression would be.
So you're talking about downregulation of CD of co-receptor during development, right? So with our, we're kind of very careful with our double positive gate that we include all the cells which are at that earlier stage of downregulating. And actually, this, you know, what we liked about this system is that the cells at these different stages, you know that these are about, you know, 24 to 48 hours, and these are 72 hours. The cells that you identify here, which are downregulating the CD8 receptor, they're a very mixed bunch. You've got some cells which are doing it very rapidly, and you've got some which are taken, you know, 3 days to downregulate. So it's very heterogeneous. But for that reason, you know, that's why we include that in our total double positive, so we consider them to be double positive cells, although you know they are modulating receptor, albeit at different levels. So having developed, so having identified this developmental sort of schematic of sort of order of events, then you know, discussing with Andy in the pub, you know, it was obvious that this could be a good developmental scheme that we could apply a sort of modeling approach to try and get some quantitative information about the dynamics of this developmental process. So just using our different double positive populations and our single positive populations, we can put it into quite a simple five compartments developmental scheme. And then we can simply have parameters which identify flux between these different compartments and you know, hopefully convince you that these arrows are sort of biologically sort of validated. Importantly, we attributed independent death parameters at each of these stages. So although in fact, when you talk to people, the efficiency of this process is thought to be, you know, cells undergoing positive selection, for instance, is thought to proceed very, very efficiently with quite sort of low levels of death. You know, Andy was quite, you know, insistent that we had to have independent values, and this turned out to be critical, in fact, for the modeling, because these become very important. We have maturation rates to capture the flux between these different compartments. We have a single input rate, which is the input from the double negatives. And then we have a thymic output rate. And I mean, we don't actually make any assumptions about positive and negative selection, although there's certainly lots we can sort of discuss about that. But what we have here then is like it's a combined sort of output from the system. So this could in principle include negative selection of these cells, but also the egress of mature cells out of the thymus into the periphery. And you know, when we did this originally, we were interested just in sort of global death rates, maturation rates, and not making any assumptions about the cause of death. And then obviously, if you've got these different parameters, then you can draw up equations which will describe how the size of these populations change with time, given various the different parameter values. So then, having established our sort of schematic for the model, then we generated time course data which we could use to help identify specific values for these different parameters in the model. And so we had the data I showed you already just shows you where you have co-development of both CD4 and CD8 lineages. But as a sort of what we thought would be useful is actually to be able to look at development of CD4 lineage cells in isolation. So we generated mice which lack the class 1 MHC alleles, so therefore they can't select CD8 cells. And then we also looked at class 1 restricted in the same way, where we had mice which lack class 2 MHC alleles and they couldn't select CD4, so therefore we're only looking at CD8 lineage, with the hope that we could identify independent parameters for CD4 and CD8 lineages separately and when they're selecting together. So this shows you the kind of time course data you can generate with these mice, looking at frequency of cells amongst the thymus. And you can see that the DP2 population develops very rapidly. DP3 follows on a little bit later. And then you have this sort of quite distinct development of CD4 and CD8 single positives, whereas the CD4s come up really quite quickly, and the CD8s lag about a day or two behind. And then if you can superimpose on top of this the time courses we generate when we have just class 1 and class 2 restricted cells, so the CD4s are always in red and the CD8s are always in blue. So you get sort of some sort of fairly comparable time courses. So the DB2 has come up pretty rapidly, though not quite to the same level as in the controls. You don't get any CD4s in the absence of class 2. And of course, you don't get any CD8s in the absence of class 1. So we had this nice time course data in which to identify the parameters. That's percent of thymus. So for various reasons, rather than looking at absolute numbers, we're looking at just the percentage of cells. And that's for sort of a number of technical reasons with the system. So one of them, the chief one, being that the ZAP transgene only expresses in about between sort of 40 and 60% of the T cells. So the absolute number that you get back is always going to be dependent on the efficiency with which that ZAP transgene was expressed. So what we do is we can identify the cells which those 40 to 60% which express the ZAP, and then we look at the percentage just of those cells. So in an ideal world, we would have absolute numbers, but...
Yeah. In your original cartoon, you had, I guess, proliferation after DP1, right?
Not proliferation. No. I mean, from going from double negative to double positive, there's proliferation. But we see, so when we did experiments with CFC-labeled DP1 cells, you get virtually no proliferation at all during development. And then when they become single positive, by about day 7, you can start to see... like one peak appearing in both CD4 and CD8, and it's known that the single positives start to undergo some limited division in mice at that late stage. So an inherent assumption of the model is that there's no proliferation, and so that was important to validate that.
So the DP3 graph is quite fascinating, right? Because in the right curve, you get still lots of stuff, and then this doesn't go out. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, so I always think people are never going to notice that, but they always do. Yeah. You're all too smart. So I did have, I had a slide in preparation for this. So they say mice is, it's a good model for thymocyte development, but it's not perfect, and it has it has this sort of two features, if you like. So one of them is that it doesn't generate CD8 single positives very efficiently, which sounds like could be a sort of catastrophic for looking at CD4-CD8 ratios, but actually turns out not to be too big a deal at all. And this is because of the transgene expression being a fixed level. What we find actually is that ZAP70 is induced during thymocyte development, and this is an issue of timing of TCR signaling, that these DP3s actually get a late requirement for TCR signaling. So if you look at wild-type mouse doing this, in the TET ZAPs, they're partially blocked here. You've got about a 50% block in the generation of CD8 single positives. And actually in the TET ZAP mice, they have a higher CD4 to CD8 ratio than you do in a wild type.
These are the rescue mice, right?
Say again?
These are the rescue mice, right? Which you do the transgene and then you feed them.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. And then the DP3s then, as you notice, which are coming out in the class 2 knockouts. So what we found actually, and this is something we're kind of writing up at the moment, is that during in wild type CD4 lineage development, you get DP2s generating CD4 single positives, but this is an interesting issue of sort of repertoire and signaling, is that while this is pretty efficient. And as I say, we identified this positive feedback loop involving ZAP70, which we think contributes to this. You can actually, even in a wild-type class 1 knockout, you see a small population of DP3s. And actually, these cells are selection failures, if you like. They start selection, they get to this stage, but where the avidity is not quite strong enough, they can't quite commit to the CD4 lineage, and they become DP3s, and it's a very small population in wild-type mice. But what we find in our TET ZAPs is that this inefficiency is actually exacerbated by the ZAP transgene, and you end up with this population. But as you sort of rightly point out, what's rather interesting is that you generate these cells, but they never give rise to CD8 single positive. So it's really a developmental dead end at that stage. And I think for the TET ZAPs, because they don't have this positive feedback loop with ZAP70 feeding back to its own expression, they can't activate that loop. And I think for this 20% of those cells, that feedback loop is absolutely critical. And they can't commit to the CD4. Maybe they think they're a CD8 lineage, but actually they're not even that, and they can't actually continue.
But how do you know that you really need a class 1 to go from DP2 to DP3? Could be that the class 1 restriction sits at a DP3 to single positive stage.
Right, so again, so the class 1 could be
maybe it's not necessary to make the DB2 DB3 transition.
Right, for the 2 to 3, that may be true, absolutely.
And then it's,
yeah,
then it's,
that could be totally, I mean, that's...
That's an interpretation of that graph.
Sure. No, that's right, absolutely. No, I mean, that's, yeah, it's certainly one of the ways that we sort of think about, you know, you're starting selection to this stage, but the cells that get here, whether that transition is TCR dependent is, I mean, probably it's not, or even relies on sort of weak or no signaling. I mean, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what we would think was going on, that they're not getting sufficient signaling at least.
What about the possibility that in the TED zap you express too high a level of zap too early? In the normal wild type, you rely on the ramping up of zap 17 to really. Right?
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, that could be an issue. I mean, that's why we went to, you know, with I mean, that's why the transgenic. I mean, it's a great, you know, I really love the system, but it does have those, not having that, you know, positive feedback. There's all those kind of questions. You know, what happens to a cell when it instantly gets that? And that's why the validation.
That, maybe you put that in the positive feedback mode.
Yeah.
Too early, right? So.
Yeah. Well, I think. I mean, it's. I think it probably. I mean, that's. It's certainly a conceptual issue, but I think in sort of practicalities terms, then I mean, the DP2s upregulate ZAP70 very rapidly. In fact, so if you look at the ZAP70 expression in a DP2, it's about the same, if not a little bit higher than what you get in the TET ZAP, and that happens with for a wild type cell, and that occurs over, you know, about that sort of 18 to 24 hours. In fact, it's about, well, it's about, you know, it's day one to get the DP2s, and then the next day to get the CD4s. I mean, it could be an issue. I don't. You know, to sort of detract from that, but the I mean, we're in a lot of ways we're lucky that the transgenic expression is as similar as it is to wild type.
I guess the other issue there is, although you use the DP3s as a convenient box, thinking of it as another subset, it's really only a subtle difference in two markers. And
sure,
you know, maybe whatever DP3 is, these guys aren't real DP3s. And
well, I mean, that's a sort of fair comment. We've done a lot of transcriptional analysis of these populations. We sorted them all out, and we've looked at gene expression. And so we know quite a lot about the genes they're expressing. And you know, DB2s and DB3s are very different genetically from one another. Those blocked DP3s, as compared with wild type, they look a little bit sort of halfway between a DP2 and a DP3. There's some things which are sort of high on a DP2, which are low on a DP3, and they sit sort of in between. Although, I mean, there's lots of reasons why even that might be, just with the dynamics of how long they're sort of persisting for and such like. And the gene array is only ever on a population of cells as well, anyway. But, you know, they're clearly distinct genetically from CD8s and from DP2s, so we do think they're quite a distinct population.
Boundary,
yeah, sure. It's yeah, absolutely. That's a sort of limitation of the whole flow analysis thing, that you draw these sharp boundaries, but it's, you're looking at overlapping populations or even continuums. And we know that these cells it's not a smooth kinetic of upregulation of TCR going from 2 to 3, but it's not a linear upregulation in terms with time, but it is a kind of continuum. They sort of jump up and they hover and then they gradually move over. And we've looked at other systems. We've got cohorts of cells watching them move through those stages. When you look just at class 1 restricted cell development, for instance, they do that rapid jump and they sit and then they gradually move across.
But the point being that maybe during the battery,
yeah, sure. So that's absolutely right. Yeah.
20% of you see DP3 is actually really DP2, but that just happened to be.
Well, the DP3s, I mean, it would suit me very well if they weren't real DP3s in that class 1 knockout mouse. But and we kind of like we look pretty hard to see whether we could say, oh, they're really DP2s. But actually, you know, they do have this high level of TCR. They do have the low CD5. The genetic profile is different. So we come to the unassailable conclusion that they really are that population. And I take your point about the boundaries, but the wild type class 1 knockouts are the best control because they have a much smaller population. And it's almost, you know, you'd almost think it wasn't there unless you look carefully. It was only because the TetZap did this that made us actually go back and look very strictly at the wild type class 1 knockouts and actually see that they also had those cells. When you actually do the it's tempting to think they're not there, but when you gate them and enumerate them, you can actually see, yeah, I've got the, it's not on this slide actually, but we actually enumerated those cells in the class 1 knockouts, and you know, they have in a wild type, it's about 0.4% across here, so it's, you know, so it's sort of definitely there. So with all those kind of caveats, yeah, so we use these time courses then to identify the parameters that would at least best fit which will best describe the data, which is, yeah, this is what I had on this slide, wasn't it? So we could identify individual values for the different parameters within the three different strains.
When you change the value of U1, 2 for the different knockouts, why not fix it as right? But you expect that the class 1 or class 2 is most important for the transition to significance.
Uh-huh.
Why not construct these parameters to be universal across all these models? And
well, I mean, I think, actually, as it turns out, it's hard to assume that that's actually going to be the case. The only ones the lambda we presume is identical across all the different mice. But yeah, exactly. And it actually, you do get into issues of when you're looking at, okay. So that was why we had the sort of class 1 and class 2 restrict. So at least we could get what we thought was sort of at least a sort of simpler system, because obviously with the two going on at once, then there's quite a lot of things potentially going on at the DP2 stage which could make parameter identification a little bit tricky. And actually you can see that this is where the model sort of does the worst job in actually predicting the behavior of the populations. It's not so bad at single positives, but it does struggle a bit with the DP2s and the DP3s, whereas when you've got at least the lineages developing separately, the model does a much nicer job of capturing the behavior of the different populations.
Is that because there's a dip?
Yeah, that could well be. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Why do you think there's a dip in the data?
There's a number of possibilities. Yeah. You don't see it as much here.
No.
I mean, there's some. We have some evidence that there's competition in the DP2 population between class 1 and class 2 restricted cells of some kind, just because when you look at the additive, if you look at these the additive, if you take those two time courses and look at the additive effect, then obviously for the single positive it's fine. In fact, for the DP3s it's fine. So if you look at the number of DP3s here, it's actually pretty much the sum of these two, but that doesn't work for the DP2s, as it turns out. And actually you get a lot more DP2s here when they're separate than you kind of would expect from the co-development. And the only way, it suggested that there must be some interaction at some level, competition or whatever, that's limiting recruitment into that. And again, that's something we had to take into account for the kind of final realization of the model.
It looks like it could be a damped oscillation. DP3 is going, they have to go to a steady state again.
Yeah, right, exactly. So it does follow in the DP3s as well. So that kind of suggests that this is a real oscillation there and it's following on, right?
So could it be the reason that what you assume is the migration, moving from one part to another, is just exponentially distributed?
Yes, exactly.
It's more complicated.
It could be. Yeah, and I think, you know, when we first...
deterministic, like, let's say it takes 3 days to, whatever, 1, 2 days to stay.
Yeah.
You could get, you know, delay in differential equation. What can give you more oscillatory behavior?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, I mean, that's true. Yeah, I mean, it's an assumption in the sort of, I think it's an exponential process. And also, I think Gregoire's point about the switch and the zap on all at once is not quite the same as ramping up the zap. And so I kind of... You know, one of the things I wonder is whether you haul in a lot more cells into selection than you might normally get in a sort of steady state situation, and then there's this kind of recovery period where
you don't get it there.
No, that's right. But that's why you think it must be sort of a, well, yeah, exactly. It could be a competition thing. I mean, it's it's arm waving, isn't it, when at this point. But I think it's you know, we tried to, I mean, we did all these mice at these, it was starting to come down at about day 7, and we thought, is it just a bit sort of noisy? And we did all the extra time points to try and, you know, see whether it would hit a plateau, and it really does seem to come down. So I think that's a real effect, but we don't really know.
These guys later for longer, maybe they will come down as well or not.
We haven't gone beyond, maybe. I mean, these certainly look much flatter than this, but this, you know, and then, you know, we weren't sure if this was real, but we did a lot of mice and we couldn't sort of get away from it. It does seem to be a real effect, and as Rob pointed out, you can see it falling into the DP3, so that's probably the best evidence that's the case. So looking at the parameter values then in some detail then. So this is just plotting out the maturation rates for the difference. So 4 and 8 is when you've got both lineages together. This is looking at 4s alone, this is looking at 8s alone. And this is the going from DP1 to 2. This is for generation of CD4 single positives. This is for generation of DP3 cells from the DP2s. And this is generation of CD8 single positive from the DP3s. So in terms of the input value here, we get about a rate, a sort of per cell rate of about 0.23, which actually, when you look at historical experimental data, that's pretty much bang on with what you see with BRDU. If you feed mice with, I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but if you feed mice with BRDU, you can see about 25% incorporation into the DP population every day. So we think that's actually a pretty close value to what's been sort of validated experimentally. It's so I'm told it's a cell per day rate. So, you know, out of 100 cells per day, 23 would have come from the double negatives. So you get some rate of maturation from here to here, from DP1 to DP2. Then I guess consistent with the rapid rate of generation of CD4 single positives, you have higher rates of maturation from DP2 to CD4, and then lower rates of DP2 to DP3 and DP3 to CD8, which again is just really descriptive of the data, the fact that the CD8s come out slower than CD4, and this is just sort of putting some numbers on. So it doesn't explain why there's a different ratio, because the different rates alone wouldn't be able to account for different 4-8 ratios. They just, you know, reach their equilibrium at different times, and they could still be, you know, 1-to-1 ratios. But, you know, it kind of makes sense with the data, at least, that you're seeing higher rates. And, yeah.
The fact that U3A goes up when you're in the class 2 knockout, does mean that you have competition between CD8 single positive and CD4 single positive?
For here, do you mean going from DP3 to CD8, as opposed to the rate there? I think this is because at this point here, we've got those. I mean, this is the total DP3 compartment, and I guess that's also including those misdirected cells, which are not going to leave. So as a compartment-wide export rate is going to be apparently lower. So these could actually be, and you'd think should be the same, but because they've got this contaminating class 2 restricted DP3s, and the compartment-wide rate is a little bit lower. So I guess that's probably why that is.
The same thing in DP2, DP2 stage, fourth RO higher.
Yeah, so presumably that's a similar issue, right? And we kind of wrestled with it, I'll say that quite glibly, didn't I? But we did wrestle with this because it was, yeah, are the rates different, are they the same? And also for CD4 and CD8 lineages, are these rates actually, you know, here different or the same from one another? And actually, it does become quite important when you're thinking about you know, the overall, the mixed DP2 compartment versus the sort of the pure DP2 compartment. And I'll mention that in a moment, actually.
One thing you could do is you could actually force them to be the same and see if you're actually describing the data statistically worse.
I guess, yeah. Again, it's because they have compartment-wide rates, and there's actually a lot of things going on in that compartment.
So your molecule is telling you that for 4S, you get nothing into DP3, right? Because the mu 2-3 for 4S is essentially zero, right?
Oh, no, that should be... That's not on the graph, is it? that's...
It's a problem we saw before, right? That you still get some...
No, exactly.
So I'm wondering...
Yeah, no, that's... I'm trying to think why that's not on the graph. It's actually about here.
Yeah,
so that's about 0.1. So that value is... DP2 to DP3 and the class 1 knockout. It's a little bit lower, so 0.07.
Yeah, it's fine. It's like,
It's the maturation area.
Is the inversion of that kind of a lifespan? Is that a compartment?
I think so. That's my understanding, yeah. Yeah, so you can get lifespan based. And I think that was on that table. Residency.
Oh, this is migration, so it could be shorter. That's pretty good.
Okay, so then this is now looking at death rates during selection. This is where we've got really interesting, quite unexpected findings. And so here we're looking at death at DP for the delta 1, 2, and 3. And what we find is that we have a certain death rate in the DP1s, which is expected because 95 or whatever, it's a very high percentage of the cells are dying by neglect. They should be dying. But if we look at the DP2 cells, then actually they have a really high death rates in comparison, or much higher death rates than you find in the DP1s. And again, this is now issues of whether this is, we can't say whether this is negative selection or whether it's some sort of neglected death. But I think the conventional wisdom is that the selection process is actually very efficient. And if you think that it's actually only a fraction of the positively selected cells are supposed to undergo negative selection, this is still much, much higher than you would have anticipated from all the literature that's already out there. But in the DP3s and in the and DP3s are getting quite low death rates, but in the CD4 and CD8 single positive, the exit rates are of a value which is could be either death or egress. And as I say, with the model, we don't directly discriminate that, but we do have some idea about, we think this is mostly egress, in fact, and very little death. So,
why don't you say that this is a faster rate than what you would expect on these percentages of selection? So it's a death rate of 0.5 per day, but to know what fraction of cells survives, you also have to compare it to the maturation rates. So 0.5 per day could be compatible with any level
Sure.
of selection still.
No, that's right. No, absolutely. But I mean, we weren't expecting to see as much death there. So obviously, this is going to come out from the modelling, and that's compatible with the maturation rates, as you say. And actually, it's one of those things. Hindsight's a sort of wonderful thing. When you looking at the DP2 time courses, the fact that they shoot up and then they plateau so quickly, it was. Without doing the modeling, I guess that was indicative of there must be a high death rate because you're not generating very many single positives or later populations, but that population expands and then plateaus. So clearly there is a lot of death, and I guess we could have guessed that if we thought about it sort of properly, but it wasn't expected. And I say the dogma is that selection is a very efficient process, and that cells which once they start selection, it's just then a matter of am I a CD4 or CD8, and death, I think, is not expected, other than negative selection, is not thought to
be so important. Would you have a huge background of death and registering to risk you based on image interactions rather than group risk? Right? You start with a very high rate of death, and only when you get the right image signal, you can survive. Then that makes sense, but it's at the DP2 stage that you are going to get very high rate.
Well, you're getting the neglect at the DP1s, the cells which don't have a high avidity. So this is a kind of important issue that neglect is occurring here. So these are the cells which can't, that their receptor is so poor that they can't take place in selection. And I think it's at this stage that...
It doesn't seem to be different when you go to class 1 or class 2 knockouts.
No, sure. That's right. I mean, that actually has implications of its own, in fact. So the fact that these death rates are very similar. I mean, when you look at the... I've got it on the next slide, I guess.
Sorry, question. What's the overall death rate percentage?
So it's 0.5 per cell per day, so like 50% of the cells die in there. So maybe I'll just show you the pie charts. So this is kind of showing you sort of cellular fate for the different populations. So in the situation we've got both lineages developing, then you get, so what the model estimates that actually as many as 25% of all the DP1s actually take part in the selection process as a whole. This DP2 stage, you get a very high rate of death, and that actually, you know, almost 3/4 of the cells actually end up dying rather than continuing to select. And as I say, I think the dogma is very much that the selection process should be quite efficient and that most cells would actually proceed through, become CD4 or CD8. And then of that, going from DP3 to CD8 single positive, you know, 2/3 of the cells are selected, and maybe this, you know, speaks to that misdirected population, which obviously all of those die in the class 1 knockouts. For the CD8, when you look at CD8s alone, it's even more sort of dramatic that most of the cells which are generated at that DP2 stage actually undergo, at least from these point estimates, are predicted to undergo a death. So the fact that those death rates in the class 1s are, I mean, that's part of the issue that the death rates are sort of similar between the class 1 and class 2 restricted. And with the kinetics of the onward development, actually suggests that so this data here suggests that the precursors in the DP1 population are not limiting for generation of CD4 and CD8 lineages. And if anything, it kind of estimates that maybe there's, you know, if anything, the TCR repertoire is slightly more class 1 restricted than class 2 restricted cells. But this doesn't, you know, what, if it was a precursor problem, limits, then you might expect this pie to be much bigger than this one here, and that's why you have the skewed CD4 and CD8. And that really doesn't seem to be, well, from the modeling, that doesn't seem to be the case, at least. And the model predicts, you know, a high death rate at the DP2, but that this should be higher for CD4 than CD8 lineage cells. So, I mean, I think we sort of touched on quite a lot of the caveats of the system and, you know, possible issues and problems, and, you know, we're aware of quite a few of these ourselves. So, having got these sort of this sort of sketch for what we think is going on with development with the TET-ZAP mice, it was important to try and validate at least some of these findings to see whether it represented sort of biology. So we went back to our.
Can I ask you a question about the
issue? Sure. Size? Yeah.
You go first.
No.
So if you knock out class 1, you get less death in the DP2 stage, right?
Yeah. So these are just class 2 restricted cells here.
Just because you're dealing with percentages, no?
Is that percentages, or is it because...
I mean, the DP2 compartments are nominally pretty similar size in the two situations when you look at them. These death rates do sort of speak to a larger volume of dying cells.
If you were doing a positive selection were the major limiting factor, then if you knock out... If you then knock out one of the two MHCs, you should see a lot more death.
Positive selection
is the main selecting factor. You knock out one of the MHCs.
One of the alleles, a class 1, for instance.
Yeah,
so
either class 1 or class 2, you should see.
I think people have done that sort of experiment, and it's not obvious that has an effect on the output. And I guess these numbers don't add up either, right? That you've got about a quarter. If this is class 2 restriction, these are class 1 restricted, why is that not 50% there? And that's, you know, why we think there must be some limit to getting into the DP2, otherwise all these cells would be coming there, and they don't. I think that's probably the same, even if you're messing around with the level. I think the MHC and the selecting ligands is not the limiting factor. I guess that's what that's hinting to me. So even if you reduce, you know, your class 1 alleles, that's not necessarily going to have a third reduction in the number of CD8s that are being selected. But maybe you're selecting a slightly altered repertoire, or you're drawing in a slightly altered repertoire into selection.
No, I'm still confused. So is this massive death, as we see, is due to positive selection, and you knock out then one of the class one of the two classes, mm-hmm. you should see a lot more death.
Well, it's not, but without that MHC, they wouldn't start selection in the first place. So what you might say is that maybe this fraction here would go down because
it doesn't.
No, but Robert, maybe they die at the other one. I mean, right, 97%. If you put all these together, many.
The 21%, essentially, all of them die later.
Right.
Yeah, but that's what I'm basically looking at the middle.
Yeah, column. But so if you look at the central pie, it's 46 plus 97 times 21. So it's essentially 46 plus 20, which is the total death rate.
Yeah.
And only exactly. 33%. So now you could wonder whether 33 is different from 19, but.
33 is different from 7.
From both.
Oh, from here.
I'm basically comparing the top part.
Oh, are these? Are you saying are these?
These two.
Right.
So, yeah, exactly. So by the
both
middle
one, there are 70% dies. If one
well, that's
here, 40% dies.
No, but the 46, then you have the 21, which is blue, right?
No, okay, I have the same question, but on a much more global level.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically saying that the differences in the death rates at the SP2, DP2 level between CD4 and CD8.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the conclusion that we need to be drawing from.
Yeah. Exactly.
And then I guess my question is the same as Rob, so what could be responsible for that difference?
That's the question, I guess. I mean, that is kind of key question is why they are dying. Why do class 1 restricted or class 2 restricted die differently? I mean, what I'm trying to establish at the moment is that they are actually dying differently at all and trying to convince you of that. And I guess in a couple of slides, we'll do a bit of mechanistic stuff looking at BCL2 family members. So maybe that.
But again, the fact that you work with percentages at non-solubility, when you have a class 1 knockout, you are going to maintain the CD4 single positive. It's going to change your rate because you're dealing with percentages.
That's right, because you're looking at population, you're looking at the rate of the compartment-wide rate, right?
Right, you just have to correct for that. Right?
Yeah, but it's,
I mean, actually,
because now we would have, if this were not true, we would finally have an estimate on what fraction of cells is lost by positive selection and what fraction by negative, because we would know at what stage what is happening.
Well, except the death, we can't, I don't think we can infer anything about the nature of the death here.
No.
Whether this is negative. Well, as I said, I mean, to cut a sort of long story short, I mean, our view, our sort of biased view, which we have some data to support, is that actually there's you get negative selection, obviously, where you're getting death of the cells. Positive selection is not a 100% efficient process, and we think that there's an inherent inefficiency there, that these values are actually, rather than being 5% of the repertoire, it's like a quarter of the repertoire is at least auditioned for selection. So there's a very low stringency on entry to the audition process, which is calling that positive selection. But actually, a lot of them fail along the way, and you could say that some of that's negative selection. But we think, for the same reason that these become DP3s, we think a lot of these cells are not getting sufficient TCR signaling to allow them to complete selection. They had a good enough TCR to start, but it wasn't good enough to finish. And that there's actually there's sort of an added stringency at this point to identify the very best T cell receptors, and that some of the cells will fail that stringency, not because they're negatively selection too good, but actually the opposite. So there's a blurring at either end of the kind of avidity border, and it's not a clean. It's not. I mean, to me, that makes biological sense because how are you going to identify all the receptors at this point, which are going to be absolutely perfect, and then just prune off the ones which are autoreactive? So that's my sort of slightly biased view, I guess. And we do with the ZAP70 mice, you can switch off TCR signaling, and you do see a lot of death in populations as well. So they need TCR signaling to continue selecting. So entry into positive selection is not a guarantee of exit for at least, cells can be start selection but be neglected. So you've got neglect at the DP1 where they don't even start, but I think there's also neglect during the selection process. So in terms of the sort of testing so that's sort of interpretation, I guess. So in terms of actually looking at the validating the model. So what's really important, we had all these different implications, and there's obviously lots of caveats to the system and the modeling, and it certainly doesn't prove that the model's right, so it's really important to test biologically. And one of the key things, obviously, these death rates, we should be able to follow different death rates in vivo if we do the same adoptive transfer experiments. So we actually sorted out the DP populations, and we also sorted out the single positive populations, did the same intrathymic injections, and then measured relative recovery of those cells after the adoptive transfer. So this is just reminding you of the death rates in the different populations from the model, and then this is looking at in vivo measurements of survival rates. So rather, slightly inconveniently, that it's kind of the opposite. So I'm looking at, this is death, and this is looking at relative survival. So it's the inverse. So if you look at this is looking at relative survival of...
How quick would you look? I
mean, because 2 days. This is not a time course.
Each other as well, right?
So yeah, no, well, that's, yeah, sure. There could be some onward migration, but what you're sort of saying is, for at least for the bolus of cells you put in, you know, what's the recovery and death rate for that? So if they differentiate, they could be more efficient. But if anything, you know, because the death rates are lower at later stages, that would, you tend to underestimate the death rate, I guess, from that, if you're getting onward differentiation to a more, you know, resistant population.
And when you isolate the cells, can't you just look for apoptotic markers and figure out what fraction of the cells are?
Not easily. I mean, it's, there are lots of good apoptotic markers, but thymocytes are, I mean, when detecting death in vivo is notoriously difficult. This is one of the big problems in homeostasis, is that everything's done, death is always measured indirectly by what you don't find. And actually, you know, the levels of apoptosis you're going to be getting are very low in these, In terms of the frequency, whatever mark you're using, if you're using like an activated caspase, that might only be around for a very short period. So therefore, you're looking at a fraction of a percent of the total thymocytes which might be expressing that. And just in the manipulation of getting the thymocytes out, you introduce a certain level of apoptosis. And, you know, I think it can work. And if you know, we have looked at caspase 3 activation in these different populations. In the DP2s, you can detect more cells expressing with caspase. And that's really the best apoptotic marker that we've used. If you use an XIN5 or some of these other ones, they're hopeless. Frankly, it's too much background. So with the caspase 3, it's not very quantitative really, but you can see that there are more cells. It's like 0.7% versus 0.2% of double positives, and it's not really sort of confidence-inspiring percentages to be working with. So we've done that, but it's not, it's not very... Not totally sure about how reliable that is. Just because the apoptotic cells are cleared so quickly, the macrophages hoover them up as soon as they look a bit dodgy.
Yeah, but hope things work that right, at least looking at relative levels, could give you something better.
It does fit for what we can measure. It definitely fits. Single positives have very low caspase 3 activation. DP2s have the highest level, certainly. So this is looking at cell recovery. Then DP1s, you get a certain level of recovery. And then if you look at the more mature populations, DP3s and single positives, then you get very good recovery of those cells relative to the DP1s, which is what you'd expect. These are dying by neglect, a lot of these, whereas these guys are going to sort of later stages of selection. And the DP2s, we get really poor recoveries. And that was, you know, what I was saying right at the beginning with our time courses. You know, when you do the DP2 transfers, they're really difficult to do because so many of the cells died in the adopted transfer. You never got a whole lot of material back, so they were... that kind of gave us some indication that there was a lot of death going on even then, but we couldn't figure out why we were having such a hard time doing those transfers. So this sort of validates at least that there's a lot of death at the DP2s. The CD4, the single CD8 and CD4 single positives, we get pretty good recovery of those, so we don't think there's, you know, a really high rate of deaths. Although there's some sort of exit rate here, we think that's probably largely egress rather than death, because we can certainly pull a lot of those cells back out.
You're saying a lot, but I mean, if you look at the DP1 death rate and DP2 death rate in, you know, the normal mouse, it's maybe twofold different.
Here and here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, but this is a population which should be dying, right? This is what you'd expect. So you're comparing population which is expected to die with one which is not expected to.
With the relative survival, we need some log scale, and you get, you know.
Yeah. I mean, if you actually crunch the numbers.
2 days and relative per day, you get about 0.5 death rate per day. So.
Yeah.
So in day, maybe it's threefold difference or something. Or the quantitative, I think. These are not.
I'm sure.
you know, the death rate that you...
I take your point, yeah. So this is looking at this and this.
Because that's unexpected, we didn't expect it before, but quantitatively I don't see it as twice as large, okay. But nevertheless,
You're getting a relative here, it's about one here, it's about four there, so you're getting fourfold fewer DP2s. So, and this is over 2 days, right? And I don't know whether that adds up or not. It's kind of in line with what you might expect, I guess.
Are you measuring survival relative to turning it relative?
Right, so I kind of skipped over that, didn't I? So because the recoveries are quite variable with these experiments, we co-transfer zap knockout thymocytes, which don't onwardly differentiate, they have their own intrinsic cell death, so it's relative to an identical population throughout. And actually, zap knockout don't do as well as zap positive wild type, for instance. So they're not quite the same, but they're a good control marker cohort population. So the other really important thing actually was the difference in selection that we identified here between the CD4s and CD8s, the difference in the death rate rather. So we also did the DB2 transfers, now getting them from either class 1 knockouts, where they're just CD4 lineage, or class 2 knockouts, where they're just CD8 lineage. And actually here, we get a reduced recovery of the class 2 restricted, class 1 restricted, sorry, DP2 cells. And actually this, when you sort of crunch the numbers out, the kind of the relative survival between the two is calculated by the model to be 0.54, 8s to 4s, and actually from the in vivo transfer, it comes out very, very similar, which is kind of nice. So we can see in the animal, we can see differences in the death rate for these two different DP2 populations, whether they're coming from CD4 or CD8 lineages, and it seems to fit with the model pretty well. So what Andy did with that data then was to actually try and get around this sort of potential issue of DP2 competition that may be going on. And he used the death rates that we got from the mice separately, the lineages separately, which we kind of validated in a wild type situation. So we think that that's a fair assumption to think that those death rates are going to be the same in when the lineages are developing together. And then use that to back calculate the efficiency of development. And this is the kind of the cartoon you get out from that, the pie chart. And this is where, those issues of compartment-wide maturation and death rates become important, because you do have quite a mixed bag of cells. So Andy's doing that analysis, and what he basically sort of confirms what was inferred from looking at lineages separately is that the class 1 and class 2 knockouts the class 1 and class 2 restricted cells are present in approximately equal portions, at least in the precursors. But in the DP2, when you look at the fraction of DP2s which are class 1 versus class 2 restricted, then already, because of the high death rate in the DP of the class 1 restricted cells, they're already sort of underrepresented as a compartment as a whole. And that for the class 2 restricted CD4 lineage cells, about half of them die and about half mature on to become CD4 single positives, whereas for the CD8s, it looks like it's nearer sort of 4/5 die and only about 20%. So that's DP3, and there's a sort of low death rate there. So we think that really this the differential death rate in this DP2 stage is really key for determining the output of the thymic selection process. And when Andy crunched out the maturation rates here, going from here to here, they're actually quite similar, in fact. And that, even though they were different when you look at it as a compartment as a whole, when you can actually pull out the lineages separately, the maturation rates are not so different. It's really the differential death rate that seems to be the sort of key determinant. So in the last, this is where I would normally say in the last sort of 5 or 10 minutes, but we'd be a little longer than that. So then this sort of comes back to your question about why are the class 1 and class 2 restricted cells actually dying? So I think the modeling suggests to us, and we have some evidence to sort of back it up, that the reason that we're getting this skewed CD4-CD8 ratio is not because the precursors are limiting, but because there's really very different efficiencies of selection of the two lineages, and that the class 1 restricted cells are dying much more precipitously. So the question kind of comes as to why this this might be. So there's a lot known about regulation of apoptosis in cells in general, and particularly in thymocytes. I mean, the thymus has been used as a common model for regulating, for looking at apoptosis. And essentially, just to sort of summarize, and this is very much a sort of summary of an enormous field, the regulation of apoptosis during these processes is in part via the mitochondrial pathway, and this is the pathway we've specifically looked at, whereby when mitochondria become when their membrane integrity is reduced, they release cytochrome C, which induces apoptosis, and this is a key way of cells getting killed during thymic development, and that there's key proteins involved in this process. There's executioner proteins, BACs and BAC, which will induce apoptosis, and these are sort of counterbalanced by these inhibitor proteins, BCL2, XL, and MCL1, and these can actually prevent these proteins from multimerizing and permeabilizing the mitochondria. And then, it's quite a complicated system of balance and checks. There's also D-repressors, which are proteins which can inhibit these inhibitors and allow the executioners to kill, to activate apoptosis. And then there's other proteins which have a sort of dual role that can actually, whose expression can exacerbate these executioner proteins and also block the inhibitors. So you've got a little sort of circuit going on there regulating. So what we did was really just to look at the expression of these factors, and it turns out to be sort of reasonably straightforward message. Although it's quite a complicated picture, it's quite a straightforward message. And so what you see is that there's actually, rather interesting, there's this kind of, when you look at the inhibitor molecules, I mean, the executioners are pretty much flat throughout development. So this is looking at the different stages of development in these different colors, and then this is looking at level of expression, at least gene expression. So making the assumption that protein is going to be directly related to message.
Are all the molecules transcription factors?
So these proteins here, whoops, are all regulators of apoptosis. So these are these proteins here. So these are all the regulators controlling mitochondrial apoptosis, and this is their expression level. So these are the sort of the ones which promote survival. These inhibit the executioners, and these are the executioners. So these guys are pretty flat. They don't do anything very interesting throughout development. The interesting guys are this one here, BIM, which has been implicated in negative selection. And you can see that this is a molecule which exacerbates apoptosis. This is upregulated in the DP2 stage. This is really quite high, and is still quite high in DP3 and CD4 immature single positives, but comes down in the mature single positives. But what's interesting is what happens here with these guys. So this pro-survival molecule is pretty much flat throughout development, but these do quite an interesting thing. And this is something that's been, people have known that BCL-XL is overexpressed it's high in double positive cells, and that BCL-2 is actually high in single positive cells. But what this kind of shows us is that there's this switch between the two factors that occurs during the selection as they go from DP1 to through 3 in single positive. But we think that then, this is looking at population-wide, so we don't know what individual cells are doing for all these factors. But you can see the BCL2 drops down pretty quickly, and the BCL2 actually takes a little while to ramp up. So we think that in this at the DP2 stage, they kind of have at least the gene expression renders them more susceptible to apoptosis. So if they have low levels of these pro-survival factors, and they've already upregulated this factor, which has been implicated in negative selection, but may not be the only thing it's doing. So they have, so the DP2s at least have the a sort of genetic profile which would be compatible with their high rate of death.
Excuse me, but the whole circuit goes through the executioners always,
yeah.
Right? So
yeah,
those are flat, the death rate is the same, right? No matter what happens upstream in the circuit, which is interesting in its own sake.
So the way it depends on how they're working. So it's not a signaling pathway as such, it's not activation. So these guys try to multimerize, okay, to form a pore or some structure which is going to interfere with the mitochondrial integrity. These proteins will bind to these ones to inhibit that multimerization process. these guys can bind these ones and compete with binding to prevent them binding to these guys. And these ones can do both. They can actually, they somehow enhance the pore forming activity of these things.
You're saying the level of executioners is not a sufficient information.
Exactly. So if this is a fixed level, if this goes up, then this will sequester more of this and prevent it from killing the cell.
So you're still finding, but it's not doing its function.
It's, well, whether the cell lives or dies really depends on the absolute balance of all these things and how they're all competing with each other. I mean, in most of the time, these things are not, they're not executing, because the cell's surviving.
Are you looking at the protein levels in cells?
For some we can and some we can't. So most of these, like BCL2 is about the only one there's a decent antibody for.
Okay.
And we know that the protein certainly lags behind the message.
Well, like for executioners.
So for these ones, yeah, we haven't actually validated the protein for all those different populations. But you can do a Western blot and have a look, so I guess you could do that.
But that's mRNA? Or what?
This is all mRNA here, yeah.
So that's
all
the proteins, so you don't know what the level
is. We glibly assume that it's the same, but that's quite a quite an assumption.
Well, essentially, if they're sequestered, as you say, protein level or something.
Oh yeah.
So then the protein level
has to be. The available. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Western blot, you'd see the overall protein burden, but you wouldn't know where it was in the cell and what it was doing. If you're able to look at complexes, I mean, normally everyone does denaturing Western blots. It's just like total mush in the cell.
You also expect there'd be a lot of heterogeneity if you saw the cell.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're looking just at overall population. I mean, that's the interesting. Yeah, totally. So, well, this gives you a sort of population trend, but within the populations, you know, maybe class 1 and class 2 restricted cells actually have different levels of these.
So what gives you
things.
The error bar?
It's just biological. It's biological replicates for the RNA sequencing. So, you know, you obviously have to do a number of experiments.
Zero precise measure.
Huh? Yeah, I mean, it's pretty good. Yeah. I didn't do it.
So the activators, or sorry, what they call the inhibitors of the executioners do not act as transcription factors?
No. It's all protein-protein interactions.
Okay.
And we've got another project sort of modeling all this. Yeah. So what we wanted to do with this, and this is the final kind of a bit of experiment, really, was so having shown that the cells are more, that the class 1 and class 2 restricted, we think have, you know, that they're dying at different death rates. We can see a transcriptional program which, at least in the DP2s, could explain why that stage of development is so susceptible to apoptosis. We wanted to try and get at the question of whether the class 1 and class 2 restricted had a different differential susceptibility to apoptosis. So to do that, we took advantage of some Bax transgenic mice that we had in the lab. Which they've been sort of made in the institute previously, so we got them out of deep freeze. And Bax actually is a good target because it's, as I say, it's pretty much ubiquitously, it's at a fixed level throughout development pretty much. So we took these mice, which they have an elevated level of Bax throughout development, and because of the transgenics construct used, that's kind of gives a sort of fixed elevation across all the different populations. So it's a really nice model from that point of view. So what we're doing is we're just elevating that sort of executioner burden by increasing the Bax. I'll put it there. And therefore that, you know, it's putting apoptotic stress on the cells. And then we see which of the class 1 and class 2 restricted cells are most susceptible to that apoptotic stress. So these mice, it's known that the deep double positives have a higher death rate when you overexpress Bax, and they generate fewer single positives. But what about the individual lineages? So this is showing the phenotype of the mice. And the main thing to sort of take home, so this is our cartoon of development. And what you can see is that if you look at the double positives, you can see that there's a reduction in the number of cells in the DP2 stage by about twofold or so. But what's already really striking is when you look at the DP3 cells, you can see here that there's far, far fewer DP3 cells in the Bax transgenic mice than there are in the controls. If you look at the 4:8 ratio in the most immediate single positives that are generated through positive selection, you can see again, that already you've got this here sort of 5-to-1-ish ratio in this experiment of 4-to-8, and already this ratio is right down the back, so you've got far fewer CD8s coming out of the selection process, which to us was suggesting that there's more death of class 1 restricted cells there. If you look in the recent thymic emigrants, the first cells coming out of the thymus here, you can see this skewed ratio is preserved, so this is what you get in a normal mouse. And then when you've got this Bax transgene, the ratio is still skewed at a very similar level to what you find in the thymus. And then you have this sort of mature compartment, which actually, in a wild-type mouse, you can see the ratio actually goes down a little bit, and you get more CD8s being preserved in the repertoire. So this is important because, you know, it shows that we think that the effect here is actually showing you the CD4 ratio in the Bax versus the wild-type. And you can see the ratio is skewed immediately after positive selection. But even though the transgene continues to be expressed throughout these developmental stages, there's no further skewing. So going from thymus to a newly generated cell and even to the periphery, that ratio isn't skewed further. It's really only in that DPU2 stage that skewing is set up. And it does seem that seems to be the specific stage where the cells are most susceptible to apoptosis. And I just acknowledged the people who did the work. So Charles has done pretty much all of the stuff that I've shown you today. Sim's technician does a lot of work genotyping and looking after the mice. Yeah, that's it.
Could you just give a brief review of the adaptive transfer protocol? Sorry.
Yeah, sure. So for the intrathymic injections, you mean? Yeah.
Right. In other words, you have synchronized cells that time synchronized.
Uh-huh.
So uh-huh. Make sure I understand how you
achieve. Yeah, we think that's the case with the TetZap mice as well, because they've got a starting gun with the induction. They all start from the same point. I mean, for the intrathymic injection, we just get sorted populations and transfer them.
Population, could you just remind me how you construct the population that you inject?
What's that? So here you mean, so this answers the question. So it's sorting the populations out from a normal mouse. You know, we isolate the individual double positive populations. So this is like looking for the survival, for instance. Does that address your, what are you thinking, what's your concern?
Let me ask you afterwards.
Yeah, sure.
Some of the cells, if you think they're dead, they're actually sort of hibernating and they will show up later as active B cells, T cells. They won't
differentiate into a different sort of lineage altogether. They won't become B cells. I mean, we're pretty confident about that. I mean, these transfers were actually pretty important to sort of validate what the fate of the cells was, that they, you know, uniquely. So these guys here do only become CD8 single positive, and you can't find anything else, at least over the time course that we look at. I mean, for the DP2s, it's a little bit more wobbly, and you can see some cells which almost look like they are de-differentiating a little bit, or I don't know, well, it's hard to say actually whether that's, they down-regulate their CD5, and that could just be what they do when they're actually dying. They don't down-regulate TCR, but they down-regulate the CD5, and with the high death rate in that population, that could be part of the death process.
And the 75% that you put in the mm-hmm. So your experiment's like 70
times,
so how long?
Well, we do it at a different time. I mean, for the adoptive transfer, we look at, you know, 1, 2, 3 days. You know, we just do different time points. So, you know, I see you're thinking if they went.
If they don't show up later, if they're
a T cell lineage cell, and you know, we've got all the markers there, and we know, because when we do the transfer, they have a sort of a marker on them which is unique to that donor population. So anything that results from that population, you know, we'll be able to pull it out. They have a aliform of CD45, so that we can identify all the donor population cells that we recover. Regardless, we don't make assumptions that they're. Or we don't only look at CD8 single positives if we put DP3s. We look at all the cells that we put in. We can identify them and then see and just ask what have they become, so we know that they're not doing something terribly wacky, like all becoming double negative, or DP3s all becoming CD4 single positive, and it just, you know, we didn't bother to look.
So when you write this high at this rate, do you think the utility of the CD8 versus the CD4s, is there a higher bar for the CD8s?
Yeah, that's the question, isn't it? Yeah, I don't, I mean, you know, for me, it doesn't make the high death rate. I know in some quarters is, you know, you could think of it, if you think of positive selection as being an efficient process, then the only alternative is that it's negative selection that's taking place at that point. And, you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me that the CD8s would be, well, I mean, I guess we don't know for sure. Maybe they are really autoreactive. No, that's right, exactly. I mean, my bias, because of the way the CD4s behave, the fact that, you know, the TET-ZAP isn't, you know, 100% efficient for CD4 lineage development, and, you know, what happens to a CD4 when it can't become a CD4 lineage, when it can't become a CD4, it becomes a DP3. And so that says to me already that there is such a thing as a suboptimal positive selection signal. So the fact that CD8s also rely on apparently weaker signaling to direct their commitment compared with CD4s, it's slightly counterintuitive to think that death is all negative selection. You'd think there'd be higher negative selection than CD4s because they're already reliant on high ability interactions or high levels of signaling, so you'd think more of them would be tipped over into the autoreactive, but you know, you want to call a killer experiment to really distinguish that. That's all kind of slightly correlative, so that's my bias, but it would be really nice to know for sure.
You also have that kick up of TCR levels in the CD8 and not in the CD4s.
During the DP3s, you mean? Or Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, that's the... Yes, although CD8s kind of, people think of them as depending on sort of weaker signals. I mean, what we find is that the ZAP70 gets very upregulated in that population. The TCR does get kicked up. And I think that is an attempt by the cell, which is getting weak signaling, to try and find a signal. So it's pushing its TCR up, it's pushing the ZAP up to as high as it can, and hope trying to sensitize it to a positive selection signal. So it may end up getting a similar strength of signal from a weaker avidity interaction because it has dropped its CD5, upregulated its TCR, and upregulated its ZAP. You know, that was kind of our thinking with the system in the first place, CD4 and CD8.
CD8 is a much better core receptor, much stronger binder and stuff. So,
right, that's what I'm, yeah. That's what I'm told.
I was going to ask something related to that. So if CD5 somehow downregulates TCR signaling in the DP2 stage where you have high CD5, yeah, intermediate T cell receptor, so it would seem to me maybe the cells are, you know, it's very difficult to signal for them. And maybe that's why you're getting these high death rates in DP2. It's really part of positive selection going on if you're not getting good survival signals through their receptor.
That, I'm sure that's going to be a sort of feedback. No, yeah, totally. I think it's part of the sort of feedback dampening system. I mean, the CD5 does play, we know that it doesn't completely block out TCR signaling. So if you take those populations out, we've sort of tested their efficiency to transduce signaling, and you can see that the DP2s actually do, and they're really good they're reasonably good at transducing signals. I mean, the DP3s are by far the better, but they're better than DP1s, and whether the improvement in signaling is proportional to the amount of ZAP and TCR upregulation, and whether the CD5 actually is having quite a significant dampening down, I'm sure it's the interplay between the three, isn't it? So I'm sure it will be having an effect. Okay, thanks.